A question I ask myself often is, why does Putin tolerate this weird system where PMCs are illegal and yet you allow them to operate? Well, there's several good explanations for why. One, having groups like Wagner, tens of thousands of people who could be deployed abroad, they can do the dirty work of supporting foreign regimes that you're sympathetic to or have built influence with or gain access to resources and so on. The good thing for Russia is they're in the category of plausible deniability. It's not us. It's not the official Russian military. Those are just mercenaries.
You're listening to Bite Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite Sized Business Law. Today, we're discussing Vladimir Putin's corporate takeover of the Wagner Group in Russia in the wake of the military company's rebellion in late June. After the Wagner Group uprising, Putin's now left to figure out and take over one of the most complex corporate webs ever tackled. And it's one that Putin himself helped create. Adding further mystery to the process is what exactly transpired at the meeting between Putin and the Wagner Group leaders that's been recently reported. My guest today is Peter Clement. Peter is a senior research scholar and adjunct professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and the Salzman Institute of War and Peace Studies. Before joining Columbia University, Peter was a deputy director at the CIA with a focus on Europe and Russia, and he served in many senior analytic and management positions within the CIA. Peter was also the presidential daily briefer to Vice President Cheney and National Security Council advisors like Susan Rice and Stephen Hadley. With a PhD in Russian history, Peter teaches subjects like contemporary Russian security and intelligence, and he's authored various works on Soviet and Russian foreign policy. I met Peter this past year when he served as an expert panelist at a wonderful conference here at Fordham Law, the Scott Simpson Cross-Border Institute Transatlantic Conference. This year's topic was how geopolitical instability affects the global deal market. And Peter spoke to us about Russian history, Russian foreign policy, Putin's risk calculation in Ukraine, and the dampening of business opportunities in Russia. So when the news broke that there was an uprising in Russia, we immediately wanted to hear Peter's thoughts. So Peter, welcome back to Fordham Law.
Thank you very much, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to see you again. I know that you are a very busy man right now with all of this news, but before we dive into the substance, I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about yourself. Now, I've just listed some of your credentials, not all, if you can believe that. But how does a boy from Long Island take such a deep interest in Russian history?
Oh, gosh. Well, it started in high school, really. Believe it or not, I saw the movie Dr. Zhivago.
Okay.
And that just fascinated me because I had no idea what was going on. I realized it was a pretty complex story they were telling. And when I went off to college at SUNY Oswego as an undergrad, I took my first class in Russian history. I think I had been fatigued with so much American history. Now I'm reading about a totally very strange history that's other than American history. And then I decided from there, I'd always wanted to teach. So I went on to graduate school to pursue a master's and then a PhD in Russian history because I was so fascinated with it. It's just so different. And even today, I'm completely fascinated, intrigued, and incredibly puzzled, much like I was as an analyst at CIA, because frequently we were dealing with similar kinds of issues. How do you understand the decision-making process? Why do things happen the way they do? Who's actually the power behind the throne and some of the decisions? And Putin's Russia is in some ways very similar to the days of the Soviet Union, probably even earlier in Russian history, if you think about advisors to the various Tsars and so on. So there's a lot of common themes that you can see in hundreds of years of Russian history here.
Right. How much time have you spent in Russia?
I never did a full tour there. I wish I had, but I was an analyst, not an operations officer. I went to Moscow multiple times, probably half a dozen or so on short trips, always unofficial business. Was amazing in the sense that I met a lot of my Russian counterparts in the intelligence services, from the old KGB to later the successor organization, the SVR. I had a chance on a trip with George Tenet in 2000 to meet with very senior Russian officials, get tour of the Kremlin, which was part of the Kremlin Hall where a lot of the Putin speeches were held. My favorite recollection of that visit was there was this huge hall next to the main hall in this Kremlin building. And it was just a series of portraits famous people in Russian history, like dozens of them, coming back literally 1,000 years. And it was like taking my Russian history course all over from one portrait to the next of all these people I had read about. But here it was. And that was actually very instructive because it's a lot like Putin. The Russians are truly a people that are obsessed with their own history. I have a feeling most Russians know a lot more about the history than Americans.
Right.
It's just sort of in the DNA of the society and culture.
Interesting. Yeah, it reminds you also how young our country is when you go somewhere like that.
Yeah. If you go back, say, 988 version of Christianity, Vladimir, we're talking, you know, from 988 to the present. What is that, about 1,200 years? It's pretty amazing.
All right. So it's no better time right now, though, to be a Russian expert than now with all that's happening. So can you give us a little background for our listeners about what is the Wagner Group? Is it a private military company or not? If so, why? When was it founded?
Sure. It's always good to have a couple of caveats. The first thing I want to say is there is so much that we still don't know. One of the things that bothers me about a lot of, well, frequently in trying to understand what's happening in Russia is we don't have great sources. We're dependent on leaks of material, say, on the U.S. side that you see in the newspapers. We're dependent increasingly on hard to access sources from within Russia because Putin has so thoroughly clamped down on all media. Anybody who works for the Russian government has to be very careful about who they talk to and what they say. So now when you read stories in the Russian press, the legitimate press, plus what I would call the press in exile, the ones who are still trying to do legitimate objective reporting, what are their sources and how good are they? I always look at a lot of these reports with a grain of salt. Like, how accurate is the information? That's my way of saying some of the things I'm going to be talking about today, I have a high level of competence, but others less so. And so it reminded me of a great quote. I briefed Colin Powell a few times, and he had this great opening for most of the people who would brief him. He was very clear about what he wanted. He would say, tell me what you know, tell me what you don't know, and tell me what you think. So what I'm going to do today is basically, I'm going to tell you the things that I think I know pretty confidently. I'm also going to tell you the things I don't know or that I have. There's just so little clarity that I'm very careful and caveated in what I say about it. And then I'll tell you what I think about what I think is actually going on. But it's really my opinion, my assessment of what's going on. And because of this sketchy nature of this reporting that we have, it's always very good to provide caveats on what you say. As far as Wagner goes, and here I'm in debt to Kim Martin, who teaches at Barnard and is a colleague of mine at Columbia. She has probably done as much research as anybody on the Wagner Group. She's given congressional testimony. She's written multiple articles over several years now. So I'm very indebted to her for a lot of what I've learned about Wagner. But one of the things she really impressed upon me is to say, Peter, always get clear with the definitions of a PMC. Her argument is that the Wagner Group is not a private military company because in Russia, they're illegal. There are no legal professional military or private military companies. And I'll get into that in a minute, why that's the case. So they really, even though we all say that and we all know what we think we mean by a PMC, we think of Blackwater or companies in the West, the Russian Wagner Group is really rather different than what we'd think of as a classic PMC. The second thing, a lot of people use the word mercenary. And of course, with academics, we get into all these debates about the fine print of definitions. So mercenary, I think a lot of people would agree, is you're a hired gun. You'll work for anybody. You go out there, they pay you when you pursue their agenda. And the Wagner Group is not a mercenary group either. But frequently, and you read the newspapers, that's what they're called. The reason they're not a mercenary group is they know exactly for whom they work. They work for the Russian government. Even though their boss is the Wagner Group or Prigozhin, they're working on contract for the Russian government. Sometimes they work under contract with foreign governments, like in Africa. We'll get to that later. But the reality is everything they're doing is really on behalf of advancing Russian interests, Russian state interests.
Okay, so this is a group formed by individuals with extremely close ties to the Russian government. And their goal is to spread Russia's influence. They're not just taking jobs here and there. But who comprises it? Is it soldiers? I mean, I've read that it's like ex-convicts or even currently imprisoned individuals.
You are correct. And here it's very important to get into chronology of events.
Okay.
When I was in graduate school, I had a professor who was obsessed with the importance. He was a criminologist and everything. Peter, you really need to know the month, the day, the hour. You need a very fine-tuned chronology to figure out decision-making or how things happen. And in looking at the Wagner Group, as I did a little research on this, it struck me that this issue of recruiting criminals and people from being let out of jails and so on is a very recent phenomenon that's linked to the war in Ukraine.
Okay.
Prior to this, and I'm talking about the second invasion of February 2022, not the first one in 2014.
But they were involved in that one, were they not?
Criminals?
Wagner.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Wagner was involved. They were involved both in the takeover in Crimea and also in the provinces in Luhansk and Donetsk in East Ukraine. But those were primarily, and that's the distinction, they weren't letting people out of jails just yet for that. The vast majority of the people fighting then for Wagner were retired or recently retired or people who left the military, but they actually were serious professional soldiers. Or security types or intel types. But they had kind of a military background, which is why they were a valuable commodity in terms of a forcing offer for services, foreign government or within Russia. So basically, they were much more of what I would call like kind of a professional military force. People with experience and training. And there have even been reports. Another thing intriguing about Wagner is they're not just grunts or guys who hold rifles at the front lines. Some of them have actually flown planes in Libya or actually even in Ukraine. So you've got people with very different skill sets. Some of the things I've read indicate that there are the less trained and less competent people in Wagner who are the ones who actually go and fight on the front lines, but some people would call them cannon fodder. And then the more trained, smart folks not placed in the front lines, they're doing higher level jobs for flying aircraft.
But their mission is much broader than the war in Ukraine. I mean, I've seen footage of them training people in small villages in Africa and securing borders in Venezuela. Like, I mean, they're all over the world. So what are some things they do other than fight in actual wars?
A lot of different media articles, particularly in the last few weeks, but even before the last few weeks, people were paying much more attention to Wagner. Once Prigozhin had come out publicly and said, yeah, I'm the guy who started Wagner. And then suddenly people took notice, a serious enterprise. Wagner provides a number of services. There's the classic kinds of security service for a foreign head of state. So like what I would call a Praetorian Guard, people whose job it is to be the leader or the regime or senior leaders in a government. But beyond that, they also do training. They provide weaponry. They do training in small arms and more advanced weaponry for a country's military. They also provide services like protection. So, for example, in Syria, there was a contract with the Syrian government for Wagner forces to basically set up a perimeter and protect oil sites in Dar al-Zor in East Syria and also outside Palmyra. So that's a different skill set, if you will. You know, you're basically an armed guard. So they do a number of things.
Now, how are they getting paid?
That's another great question. That's one where I will tell you, I wish I had a higher confidence level in how exactly they're being paid. And a number of people have written about this, but in general, my impression is nobody has the hard smoking gun contractual evidence of how they get paid. From what I've read, and I think most experts would agree on this, let's take the case of Africa and Central African Republic or Mali. They're being paid somehow financially, like some form of cash payments, salaries, if you will. But there's a fair amount of reporting that indicates they're also gaining revenue by providing services in the mining sector, like mining gold or diamonds, or in some cases, protecting oil facility. In the case of Syria, there was a contract with the Syrian government where in return for protecting an oil facility, the Wagner Group was given a certain percentage of the take, the revenue facility. So they would, in a sense, be kind of a part owner. So how does that translate to how you pay the people? That's my problem. The deal is you're getting some kind of revenue stream from resources, how does that get translated into cash? How do you pay your guides? Another way in which they're paid is they literally get paid as a payroll in a big company because of contracts with the Ministry of Defense, with the Russian government. And I would have had less confidence about that until very recently when Putin actually came out and said, and I think you've seen this too, that actually we've had contracts, for example, over the past year that I think were valued at some over $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to double check, like $1 billion or $2 billion.
I read $2 billion, yeah.
$2 billion, okay. To me, that was an eye-opener because here we have the most senior person acknowledging, yeah, they were on our payroll. So that helps answer part of your question that I presume there was a regular payment system, salary, where you got paid maybe weekly or biweekly or monthly with real money that was coming out of the government coffers. We can get into the corruption issue later because Putin's statement about the payment for these services, and that was for 1 year, by the way. You can imagine if you go back several years that they were on the payroll for a long time, probably talking a lot more than $2 billion. But Putin in his comment also made a point of saying that, well, we're investigating right now how these payments were managed, you know, and we want to make sure that, you know, everything was done according to the books. And if not, you know, we'll have to get to the bottom of it, which I read to mean is a form of leverage, if you will, over Prigozhin. There's still ways in which we can go after you as necessary.
So back up a little bit and give us a little background on who is Yevgeny Prigozhin, and is he the founder of the Wagner Group? And how did he become such a close ally of Putin?
He was actually not the founder. The real founder was a gentleman named Dmitry Utkin, who is a former officer of the Russian military intelligence, the GRU. And Utkin founded it back in 2014. And I'm going to go a little bit off path here because he's such a complicated person, but it's very important to know this. Utkin himself had been in the GRU, and he headed a special operation, special commando type group. And when he left the GRU, he signed up with a company called the Moran Company, which then contracted out to another company called the Slavonic Corps. The Slavonic Corps was a company registered in Hong Kong, but technically it was a legal entity based in a foreign country or registered in a foreign country. And they did sell their services to Syria. So he was fighting in Syria already as early as 2013. And I say that because the Russians didn't intervene and send the real military forces until September 2015. So he was already in the private military business in Syria 2 years before then. So Utkin then sets up in 2014 his own group, the Wagner Group. And the Wagner Group then proceeds to sign a number of contracts in foreign countries, including Syria. And they do get involved for several years in Syria. Some success, but I would call it mixed success. They didn't necessarily do so well. There were certain tensions with certain elements of the Syrian military, and I think this would fall in the category of kind of who's in command, who gives the orders, if you will, kind of classic things, particularly when you're in the middle of a war, which is very interesting now in hindsight, because if you think about what's going on between Wagner and the Russian MOD in Ukraine, kind of a similar issue. Who do we take our orders from? Who's our real boss? What if we don't like the orders we're getting from the MOD leadership, which is part of Prigozhin's beef here with the MOD? How do you resolve those kinds of issues? Syria, they would not get a new contract, or they would play a lesser role than they had originally contracted.
So how does Prigozhin get involved?
So Prigozhin, he's not a military guy himself. He has no background in the military. This is another fascinating story, a fun biographic profile, if you will. And I'm sure you've read a lot of these in the press. He was a common petty criminal in the Soviet era, spent 9 years in prison, and somehow in the late 80s got out of jail a couple of years early. And people speculated about, well, how did that happen? Was this a deal that was cut? The KGB, we want you to go out and do some work for us and we'll get you out early. There's so much we don't know about that. Anyway, he gets out and he sets up a series of hot dog kiosks. I mean, like literally hot dog stands.
Oh my gosh.
And magically from that, he suddenly gets into the catering business and sets up a high-end restaurant. And this is now, we're in the early 90s. Here's another area where we have just huge holes and gaps of information. In the early 1990s, Vladimir Putin was the vice mayor of St. Petersburg, who happened to see one of his duties was managing foreign relations. So any business dealings with foreign countries that went through Petersburg, through their ports, food sales, he oversaw all that. My understanding is he also oversaw a lot of business contracts within the city. So it's very possible that his first encounters with Prigozhin were him getting set up a business, setting a series of kiosks, and then moving up into the restaurant business, and then the catering business. And there had to be a relationship there, because when Putin later moves to Moscow, he becomes head of the FSB in 1998, and then becomes prime minister in the summer of 1999, he brings Prigozhin to Moscow to be his caterer. So clearly they had some kind of relationship. I wish I knew a lot more about that, about how that actually developed and why they got so chummy. But clearly it was during the St. Petersburg days. And for that matter, most of the people around Putin and his inner circle right now, they're all Petersburgers. They're all people who came up through the ranks in the KGB for the most part, or worked in local government in St. Petersburg in the early 1990s.
Yeah, you keep seeing these images of them walking with the white chef jackets on, or him standing behind him during a fancy dinner.
Yeah, there was one of them. It's a famous photograph where he's seen leaning over, handing a dish, I think, to Putin. But this was with President Bush in 2006. And I don't know this for a fact, but I think that somebody in the media may have conjured up this moniker, you know, Putin's chef. But here's the chef in his white suit with the hat, handing over the food at a state dinner with the president of the United States.
Right. Wow. Okay. So he's cooking Putin's meals. He's maybe testing them for poison. And then next thing you know, he's running a military company.
Yeah. This is another area where I would fall in the category if I wish I knew more.
Right.
It's not entirely clear how he came to be the overseer or the manager of the Wagner Group. And I'm still very uncertain about what kind of relationship he had with Mr. Utkin, the actual founder of the Wagner Group. And here again, there's very contradictory clues to follow. Let me just give you a couple of examples. So Utkin is still running the Wagner Group, but sometime in 2015, 2016, again, we can't document this, it appears that Prigozhin started running the Wagner. Now, in what capacity was owner of it, or was he actually working for Utkin? Because later we find out in 2017 that Utkin was named the CEO of the Concord Management Consulting Group, which in fact oversees Wagner Group. So I still don't know. And then after he's named, several months later, he resigns from that position as CEO. So this is a big mystery to me. I don't know where Utkin is anymore.
So we don't know what happened to Utkin.
So we don't know what happened. Maybe he's perfectly fine and healthy, but I don't know anything very recent about him. Obviously, Prigozhin's still around. The other thing that was interesting is Utkin went to a ceremony at the Kremlin where he was photographed with Putin in December 2016. It was an event honoring the heroes of the fatherland, like military guys and people who've done great service for the country. And he had actually won 4 different medals for bravery and service. Utkin, I'm talking about now. So he was a serious soldier type guy, and somehow he is no longer part of the scene that I can tell in this Concord group or with the Wagner group. And now all we know is about Prigozhin.
Well, this gets us actually into this complicated corporate formation of the Wagner group and where it fits in. And you mentioned the Concord group. My understanding is they're a holding company and they're the parent company to all of these subsidiaries. And there's actually over 100 of these entities underneath their umbrella. And they range from catering to finance to real estate and to the Wagner group that pursues military ends. It's a very complex corporate web, and it's in some ways unknowable because so much of it, as you're saying, is unaccounted for. You know, we don't know. We're just trying to figure it out from what we hear. There aren't many public records about it, but it seems like it helped the Kremlin amass wealth and it helped them just spread influence and things like that. So it seems that Prigozhin probably leapt from his catering company, and it sounds like he has family members running other of these subsidiaries, and that it was probably a pretty easy path for him to up to the Wagner group. So first of all, tell us, you told me offline something really interesting. Why the name Wagner?
Wagner is, It was the nom de guerre of Dmitry Utkin, the founder. And it turns out Utkin was an admirer of the Nazi system. And he was also taken with the fact that Hitler was a big fan of Richard Wagner, the German composer. And that's where he got the name from. I've also read that when he was fighting in Ukraine, he wore the Nazi-style pointed helmets, too. And this is just a very bizarre sense of affiliation with a horrific regime, the Nazis. But that's where it comes from. Again, it's so odd, hard to understand. On Concord, you're right. My understanding is that it's a large holding company with lots of entities, the catering, the restaurant business, the construction business. Now, Wagner had lots of contracts with the MOD for construction and military facilities. They also had contracts for catering with the school system in Moscow City, as well as government. That's a subset of Concord Group. The other thing that Concord does is financial consulting service. So there was an article in the Times a couple of years ago in 2022 about they have an office suite in Tarrytown, New York. And the Times reporter went up there to try to find out, interview somebody. They didn't get any answers. They couldn't find anybody. But basically what they do is they provide legal and consulting services to Russian entities and business people who have activities in the United States. So someone like, say, an Oleg Deripaska, famous Russian oligarch, very closely tied to Putin, who tried many times to get a visa and had great difficulty getting a visa to come into the U.S., they would provide the kinds of services or work with lobbyists and so on to see if they can get things done. They would also help defend Russian financial interests because people know that there's a lot of Russian money parked in different U.S. enterprises or properties, government buildings in New York, Miami, that are actually Russian owned, but through shell companies. And you need people to navigate the system of obfuscation, if you will. Multiple layers of companies to disguise who the real people are, who are the owners and have the money.
Wow. So one of the subsidiaries of Concord is operating out of Tarrytown, New York. Is that what you're telling us?
It's New York Times, March 9th, 2022. I came across this in getting ready for today, and I thought, wow, I had not seen that before.
It just goes to show how widespread and complex this corporate structure really is that they set up. I want to get into how Putin's going to get his arms around that, but first, we need to talk about why Prigozhin turned on the Kremlin. What happened? What led to this mini coup or this potential coup that we all had our eyes on a couple of weeks ago?
So again, in the category of what I know, what I don't know, what I think, for the life of me, I'm still perplexed. But I have to believe on the available evidence that this was really a feud between Prigozhin and the senior leadership of the Ministry of Defense. That's the conventional wisdom, and I very much agree with it.
So wait, Peter, is it understood that the Wagner soldiers are like a more elite group of soldiers than the Russian military? Or what's the understanding there?
That's another great question. The Wagner group is known for its ferocity, its courage. They take on the hard tasks. Many of them literally are the cannon fodder in the front lines that are taking on a large number of casualties in the war in Ukraine. The perception is, among a lot of Russians, is these are the really tough guys. They do what it takes. They're perhaps a little more violent. And there's actually a video that went around of, and I think this was in Syria, where somebody from Wagner Group beheaded an enemy, one of the enemies they were fighting.
Oh, gosh.
But at any rate, it's hard to draw a comparison between who's the better fighter. But I think most of the Russian experts in the West right now are saying the Russian conventional forces are not really great as people might have thought they were before the war. I mean, we all have this image of a large army, professional, trained, performed. That's not the way they're performing on the battlefield. Is that a function of that they're terrible soldiers, or is it a function of terrible management strategy and tactics? I think would be Prigozhin's argument. We got crazy people running the ministry, don't know how to run a war. And when they do get a good commander like Zarovikin, he gets fired or demoted in favor of Gerasimov. If I can walk back a little bit, there's a history of tension between Wagner and the Ministry of Defense predates the war in Ukraine. I thought that was important context here. I mentioned earlier that Wagner had construction contracts and catering contracts with the MOD. And back in 2016, 2017, there were in some kind of a falling out. I don't know why, but Wagner wasn't getting paid for their services by the MOD. So they sued them. They went to court and there were a series of lawsuits. And the Wagner Group wound up getting paid a certain amount, a decent amount of what was owed them. So that's one sort of friction area, if you will, that the MOD was not happy either with the services or the competence, or maybe they just hired a Prigozhin. But a more serious area where they had a major clash was actually on the battlefield, and this was in Syria. And this was in 2018, in February. There's a very famous incident that took place in Dar al-Zor in East Syria, where the Wagner Group fighters were about to engage in a major assault on Syrian Defense Force. These are the Syrian opposition group people led by Syrian Kurds who were fighting against the Assad regime. So the Wagner Group was getting ready for an assault on those fighters. And U.S. forces are embedded with the SDF people. There's Americans there fighting to help the Syrian opposition fighters. The U.S. becomes aware of this preparation for an assault, and the Americans contact the Russian military in Syria to say, hey, there's something in the works here. You need to tell you guys to knock it off, because if they launch this assault, they're going to get pummeled. We will take them out. Well, A, they never got the warning. Remember, the Wagner Group is a private entity. They don't work for the MOD, technically. They're on contract with the Syrian government. They don't get warned. The Americans bombed them to smithereens with multiple airstrikes. And this is a multi-hour assault. It's many, many hours, many, many casualties. I've read anywhere from scores to hundreds of people that were either killed and or wounded. And the Russian media acted like, well, first they understated it, and B, that wasn't the Russian military. Those were just like mercenaries. The MOD left these guys to hang out to dry. That was a source of some contention between the MOD and the Wagner people, sure. And you can possibly draw a parallel with the more recent past in Ukraine, where Prigozhin, after the Battle of Bakhmut, where the Wagner force did a lot of the heavy lifting on the front, and it was a slow, laborious process. They took a lot of casualties. Prigozhin started to go public in his social media, complaining of the lack of support. They weren't provided sufficient ammunition, weapons, or just general support on the battlefield, and therefore they suffered a lot of casualties. So he was very, very open and critical of that.
I didn't know that story in Syria. I mean, that's enough to make you hate the Russian leadership. And then clearly he thinks they're not as competent as him and they're not trying as hard as he is. He's putting everything on the line and he's not getting the support he needs. But what makes him turn his tanks towards Moscow?
So the precipitating factor, I was attuned to this on June 10th. When I first heard that a decree was about to be issued, it was issued on June 11th, that all contract entities like Wagner would have to sign brand new contracts whereby they directly report to the Ministry of Defense. So the way I read that was, oh my gosh, this is a huge deal, because what it looks like now is Putin has finally come down on the side of the MOD in its war of words, because it was very public, social media, between Prigozhin and the Ministry of Defense leaders. That would be Defense Minister Shoigu and Chief of General Staff Gerasimov. So there was this tension, and most people, myself included, thought Putin seems to be tolerating this tension. Maybe he thinks it's effective. It makes the MOD work harder. It makes Wagner feel important. This is not a bad thing. In my view, it's an absurd thing. I have kind of two lines of authority and who works for who, and very unhealthy in my view, if you're trying to run a military force. So the announcement of this decree, in my view, signaled that Putin was now saying, okay, knock it off. Everybody's going to report to Shoigu and Ministry of Defense. And Prigozhin has said this. He said, hey, when we saw that, we're not doing this. My guys are not going to do this because we think these leaders are so incompetent and bad. So I think he has said himself that was the precipitating event that led him to this decision to go do this. The other thing I should mention, a question I ask myself often is, why does Putin tolerate this weird system where PMCs are illegal and yet you allow them to operate? That just doesn't compute. Either they're legal or they're not. And if they're not legal, why are they allowed to exist? Well, there's several good explanations for why. One, having groups like Wagner tens of thousands of people who could be deployed abroad. They can do the dirty work of supporting foreign regimes that you're sympathetic to or have built influence with or gain access to resources and so on. The good thing for Russia is they're in the category of plausible deniability. Like I said, that case in Syria, well, they're not. It's not us. It's not the official Russian military. Those are just mercenaries. So that doesn't really mean anything, when clearly it does. You're doing things that really benefit the Russian government. A second reason is when these people die, you don't have the blowback in the media. A, you don't acknowledge it. The data is hard to find on how many of them are actually out there. And then you don't have opposition groups. There's a famous opposition group in Russia that grew up during the Afghan War in the 1980s. The mothers groups who would protest about their children dying in the war. Well, if these are all mercenaries and not officially military people, it's hard to even get information. And by the way, they volunteered for this. Putin finally came out and acknowledged the Wagner group at a big press conference in November of 2022, I believe, and said, yeah, Wagner is an entity. They have businesses abroad. And as far as I'm concerned, they can do all the business they want anywhere in the world as long as they abide by Russian law. So he admitted that they exist.
And now he's admitting that he pays them.
Yeah, no kidding. To me, these are all fascinating revelations that just add more to the mysteriousness, the complexity of this relationship.
So what were you thinking, Peter, when you first saw the news that they marched on what, Rostov-on-Don, and they were coming within miles, right, of Moscow?
Yeah, they'd made pretty good progress on the main highway.
What was going through your head?
Well, I was dumbfounded, to be candid. I was in shock that he had the temerity to do this. And then, you know, you ask all the obvious questions. Did he think he was going to generate support? Did he, in fact, have high-level backers who were winking and nodding, yeah, this is fine because we don't think the MOD is doing a good job either? Why would you think you could get away with this? Now, one theory is that Prigozhin just got too full of himself, started to believe his own press, because they were becoming famous. I think in our conversation the other day, you know, there's billboards, major cities, recruitment billboards for a Wagner group. They have big buildings with the Wagner logo on the front of the building. They're like a legitimate entity. And maybe he began to believe that everybody understands how great and wonderful we are and that people will back us in terms of public opinion. Now, maybe he wasn't entirely wrong. As you noted yesterday, there was a lot of positive reception in Rostov-on-Don. People actually were applauding these guys when the crisis passed and they were getting ready to leave. People were shaking their hands and applauding. And I'm sure if Putin watched that, he's wondering, my God, you know, what have I created? And that's actually the bigger point. I think Putin ultimately is responsible for this mess. He let this tension fester between Prigozhin's Wagner and the MOD. And I wonder sometimes whether he viewed this the way this was a successful tactic he had employed elsewhere in his political life. If you look back to the period after he became president, he very effectively managed to play off one oligarch against the other, and he made himself the arbiter. And I was thinking, you can play that role when you're dealing with government bureaucrats who are fighting about turf between different agencies, between business entities who are in competition, and you play, it's like the Godfather here. You pick sides, you pick the winners, and everybody understands the only person who can fix this is him. That's a very powerful position. Now, maybe he thought he could play the same game with the military and the Wagner group. But the difference for me is that these guys have guns. These aren't guys with suitcases with money or an office in a bureaucracy in a big building. Is that really a group you want to empower to engage in this kind of bureaucratic warfare?
But you're right. I mean, to think that Prigozhin is brazen enough to think he would get away with this. I mean, as I saw it unfold, you're just thinking, oh, he's a dead man. Like, he is a dead man. So what is the Kremlin's response? You see them immediately send in the FSB to the Wagner headquarters. They start to dismantle it. They're blocking their social media channels. They're seizing computers. They're going through their corporate documents. So it was interesting. And his reaction was, I am going to take over, conquer it. I'm going to take over all of these entities. You saw the Wall Street Journal compared it to Great Britain liquidating the East India Company in the 1800s. And they actually said, Not since then has the world seen a government try to swallow a corporate empire comparable to Wagner. So it's not like what we think of like as a hostile takeover in the US. Like one company comes in and they like, you know, have a proxy battle and they acquire enough shares and they take over a corporation. This is the government coming in, trying to take control of this massive web that it helped create. And I mean, immediately it made me think, does he have the bandwidth to do this? Is this a major distraction to the war efforts in Ukraine? Because they want to dismantle it. Putin's probably got a big stake in this and it's important to him. And it's, you know, it's gained wealth and resources and influence for Russia. Is this Prigozhin's punishment? What's going to happen to Prigozhin? But then you see reports that actually they're together 5 days after this uprising. So I don't know what to make of what's happening now with his taking control of the corporate entities or not.
This is one of several what I call billion-dollar questions. I'm still recovering from this announcement yesterday. This meeting with 35 people, and I'm dying to know the composition, by the way. 10 of them commanders and 25 of them Putin people. There's so much we still don't know about this meeting. And Peskov, his press spokesman, says, we don't have any details. Sorry. Like, this is still kind of a secretive meeting, if you will. But I'm still shocked that this is days after Lukashenko had struck the deal. Lukashenko struck this deal announcing, you know, the three options for Wagner people on the 24th. And 5 days later, here we have Prigozhin in the Kremlin. By the way, I'm also wondering security. Can you imagine if you're Putin security people and you got 35 guys in a room with him? I had difficulty believing this, to be honest. Really? This is a man who doesn't like big groups anymore because of health reasons. And from a security perspective, these are like military guys that you don't necessarily trust entirely. You really have them in a room. Like, presume they went through metal detectors and all that, but still, the whole thing is surrealistic. So this is 5 days after the announcement by Lukashenko of the deal.
Tell our listeners what the deal was.
So the Belarusian president announced that after he had been consulting with Putin, and then he'd been in contact with Prigozhin, in that order, by the way, the deal was, you have three options here. Wagner people can sign up and hope to do the right thing and sign a contract with the MOD, or you can just be detached from the MOD and go to Belarus with Mr. Prigozhin. Stay there. Or you can go home, wherever home is. And of course, I wondered about that. I wondered, is that really an option if you go home and everybody knows who you were? Are you going to get arrested or something? Treasonous? They seem like really wide open options. But at any rate, I wondered if at this meeting 5 days later at the Kremlin, were they hammering out the fine print of this understanding about what the deal was? Or were they now getting to the nitty gritty of what you asked about, Amy? Okay, what's going to happen to the Wagner Group and Concord writ large in terms of who's running the operation these days? You, Mr. Prigozhin, or is it somebody else? My first thought when I first started reading about this issue about the British Empire and, okay, who's going to control this? I initially thought, gee, you just hire a new guy and say he's the new CEO and everybody goes about doing what they normally do. But the reality is a lot of these people actually have loyalty to Prigozhin, who are running these operations in the countries. They probably are there because they have a relationship with him and their loyalty may be to him. So it's not a simple handover of there's a new leadership in town. That could be a problem. The other aspect of this, probably pretty important to Putin, is these are big money revenue generators, I think. If you're getting access to these mineral resources, be it gold or diamonds or oil, gas fields, and so on, plus arms sales to countries, that's probably an important piece of financial revenue for the government.
I read somewhere that the governor of St. Petersburg, who absolutely hates Prigozhin, made some comment like he basically runs the entire St. Petersburg economy.
I hadn't seen that. He obviously must have some wealth that he's generated in Petersburg.
But the point is, you're right. I mean, Putin doesn't want to give any of this up.
Today, I saw another account from Bloomberg saying they had several sources who claim that Putin has agreed to let Prigozhin maintain the operation in Central African Republic.
Surprise, surprise.
So then I got to thinking, well, gee, is it just one or bigger than that? They reach a deal on what sense does it make to screw up this very lucrative business we have going African countries. Maybe we can just leave that alone and Prigozhin keep running the enterprise, just make sure we get all of our money.
Well, why didn't Putin really stick it to him? Why was he so kind to him?
I have no idea. That's the part that's really perplexing me the most, is I think back to Putin's dealings in St. Petersburg. I mean, he had ties to a lot of quote-unquote business people, but also there were links to organized crime groups at the same time that Prigozhin business. So I wondered, and this is way, way out of the box, but I was wondering, does Prigozhin have something on Putin? I mean, some critical information or some knowledge plus access to details that would be very, very damning. I mean, that sounds almost crazy. Get rid of him and then there's no problem, but I can't explain why it is he's letting him off the hook. He just called him in a major speech, there's a traitor, there's a threat to the country, a big crisis akin to 1917, which I thought was a great exaggeration. And then you meet with him, and then you say, what? You know, we'll let bygones be bygones. There's a very good article in today's New York Times, and there's a scholar at Carnegie named Snovia. He made a very interesting point that you like this quote. So for Putin, Prigozhin is, of course, a traitor. But he's his traitor. This is a person who made a mistake out of stupidity rather than of malice. So, you know, that old adage about, you know, well, they're bad guys and they're dictators, but there are dictators.
Yeah.
We used to talk about groups in U.S. foreign policy that we may have supported certain bad regimes. It was an interesting logic. The other point she made was that maybe Putin realizes that at the end of the day, he's kind of responsible for what happened. This point I made earlier. When you allow a horrible thing like this to fester between the Ministry of Defense and a large group, military entity, you created this mess. Now you need to fix it. I still am waiting to see, is anything going to happen to Shoigu and Gerasimov? I don't know that he could do that, because then it would suggest that Prigozhin won. Then he looks even weaker than some people think he looks now. It's just so odd.
Now, I was thinking back when you were at Fordham for our transatlantic conference, because we talked a lot about Russia and Ukraine, but we also talked about China. And I read this wonderful New Yorker article where you were interviewed in. And one of the points that was really well made in that article was that historically, authoritarian regimes are like these tightly controlled and very strictly run machines until they aren't. So it's like one of the features is you do sow discontent, you do make enemies. And it made me think, I wonder how places that are still doing business with Russia, like China, I wonder how they viewed this episode. Because like you're saying, it seems like it's quite a mess right now. And I mean, they almost had this big state failure. I mean, if you're still doing business with Russia, are you second guessing their stability?
Well, Keith Gessen was the author in it. He's the one who made that point about, you know, we're strong until they're not. So many examples from the Arab Spring. I mean, Mubarak. Everybody said Egypt ran this unbelievably tight security state. Didn't. In a matter of days, it's gone. Same thing in Tunisia. Didn't quite happen in Syria because Assad said, I'm going to shoot everybody. And instead, he had an 11-year civil war now, which is destroyed his country. But in the case of Russia, I'm not as pessimistic, if you will, about an immediate failure. I think it still is a very strong police state. Putin still controls our knowledge. All the critical security and intelligence entities in the military. So to get rid of him, I think, would be really, really hard. We had an insider, true insider. And most of the people around him, they share responsibility with Putin for this war. The critical deciding point here is this crazy decision to invade Ukraine. Putin consciously had a meeting that was televised with the Security Council 3 days before the invasion in February 21st, 2020. Where every single member of the Security Council basically raised their hands and said, here are all the reasons why this is a great decision, boss, which was clearly staged. But the point is, how could any of those people work against or undo him? They're all as culpable as he is for this really crazy decision. He's mindful of the fact. I think one of the points that I made with Keith was dictators, they're always looking over their shoulder. They probably don't trust many people. And so you always need to be mindful that there's potential, but he's done a pretty good job of managing all the people, his immediate circle. The one thing again, in more of the out of the box category, there was an incident about a year ago. There was a woman on the major Russian TV station on TV One. Her name is Zvyanikova, and she ran across the screen with a big poster about how horrible the war was. And it was just a major TV channel. And people were shocked. And I thought, this woman's got a lot of courage. And it turns out that she has Ukrainian blood in her family, either her mother or father was Ukrainian. And when I first saw that, my immediate reaction was, I'll bet Putin has called up the head of HR in the Kremlin and said, I want a background check on every single person who's in every hallway in this building that I might run into. Because it only takes one person who has some vendetta or some reason to want to do you in. You might have an assassination attempt. I'm guessing they have really good security, the Kremlin. But it just struck me that there's a lot of people with interesting family backgrounds on who may have other agendas because they're mad about this war.
It's interesting, too, because, I mean, it's one thing to be a random citizen who runs across a show with a sign. But when you see someone as powerful as Prigozhin speak out against the war in Ukraine, it kind of gives other people a license to say, okay, maybe we can express our dissent. So I'm interested to see what will happen, because not only did he speak out, I mean, he was basically forgiven.
The thing that I think is a big unresolved question is Prigozhin actually had the temerity to say the real reason we went to the war was not what President Putin told him. We went to war because of greedy people, oligarchs and people in the military who saw this as a great opportunity to grab up more resources in Ukraine because they're corrupt. And I thought, oh my God. And he said, we're not denazifying. There's no NATO threat. And he completely undermined and challenged the narrative that Putin put out to justify the war. In some ways, that's almost more serious than the march up the highway, which I think was ultimately going to be manageable. But this, and I've yet to see Putin or others come out and take this on in a serious way. But that was pretty radical.
So, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. It's almost like the world cannot unhear those words. And there is no way that you could, at least to my mind, argue anything other than what Prigozhin said for the reason that they entered. I mean, he made a lot of sense. He spoke to a lot of people when he said that.
Yeah.
So do you think that Putin's sleeping with one eye open? Do you think there are others in Prigozhin's circle who, as you mentioned earlier, probably supported him turning on the Kremlin, who Putin's now weary about?
I frequently use the metaphor of, you know, we're reading a big novel, about 8 chapters, and we're in chapter 3.
Okay.
There's many more things that are probably slowly unfolding to which we have no visibility right now. And I am wondering exactly that. Will there be a purge, for example? Not a purge like the Stalin purges. People get removed from positions. Putin figures out, well, you know, this guy and that guy, they didn't really say much during the crisis. In fact, they were kind of ambivalent. You know, can I trust them? They need to be removed? Or on a more serious level, you actually do go after high-level people and you fire them. Fire them and maybe find cause to have them brought up on charges. But you basically send a signal that all of you who didn't do the right thing, you're all done. No future. I would kind of lean in that direction, that slowly now we're going to see some things unfold that do suggest Putin is, in fact, making sure that there's no either disloyal or on the fence. I've always wondered why, for example, the FSB has gotten such a clean bill of health on this. You read the stuff that has come out about their intelligence analysis and their polling data in Ukraine in the war, they made some pretty terrible assessments of the likely Ukrainian reaction, how easy it would be to march on Kyiv, and basically we just decapitate the regime and in a matter of weeks, there's no problem. Surprising that Putin would actually believe that and not get an alternative view. But if the FSB did in fact provide all this terrible analysis, why aren't they being removed? Why hasn't somebody been fired over there? Then again, we know that Putin never saw it. Did anybody actually show him this data? This is, again, the murkiness question, so I'm always hesitant to make huge assumptions. But if the word was out that that was the reason why he made such a terrible error in judgment to invade, we'd think heads would roll over there. But he needs the FSB. That's the flip side. They're the ultimate domestic security entity, so maybe that's one you don't want to tamper with.
Right. So in your estimation, Peter, does this steal Putin's resolve in Ukraine, or does this make him more amenable to a ceasefire?
Yeah, that's another million-dollar question. If, in fact, Putin now feels that domestically he's a little more less solid than he was before, that he needs to totally refocus his energies on his domestic political power, and like I'm saying, maybe go after people, really shore up his position to the point that he used to be before the war. If that's his main priority, would he be more open to some kind of a ceasefire? I don't want to say making a deal on Ukraine, but even a ceasefire, which the West would say, well, we've heard that story. We don't trust you. A ceasefire isn't going to work because you're just going to buy time. He could say, no, I mean a real ceasefire, and we'll have international observers on the line of contact to keep the forces apart, and we're serious about it'll be a ceasefire so we can work towards some kind of a negotiation. Secretly in the back of his own mind, he's thinking, yeah, I am buying time, and somewhere down the road, we're going to revisit this because Ukraine is so important to me in terms of this vision. I talked about at the conference, this vision of uniting this Russian world, the Bavakor. That's a possibility. I wouldn't say it's high odds. But if he does sound a little more open to a ceasefire, then that would tell me he's actually worried domestically, that he right now needs to concentrate on securing power more thoroughly. But right now, as we said yesterday, fighting continues. The missiles keep flying. We're attacking major Ukrainian cities. The war isn't letting up. One other data point that caught my eye yesterday, Erdogan made a public statement. He said that Putin's going to be going to see him in Turkey next month. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting little tidbit, because Putin hasn't traveled abroad a whole lot since the virus. Most of his meetings, like with the Chinese and so on, have been in video. Most of the Chinese visited Moscow. So I'm wondering if it's a low probability thing about a discussion of a possible fire, who would you broach it with, or who might be your interlocutor? Well, it might be Erdogan. He's the one guy who seems to have a little credibility on both sides who would deliver that kind of a message. I could argue against that too. You're going to have a ceasefire. You probably want to talk to the Americans. He believes the Americans will mind everything anyway. So if you're going to get a buy-in, you might as well just go right to the source.
And what do you think will happen to Prigozhin and the Wagner group?
I guess I think they're sufficiently lucrative a revenue source. I don't think they want to risk losing all of these business ventures they have around the world.
And do you think they'll leave Prigozhin or someone close to him in charge? Do you think that they have the bandwidth to take it over themselves? Or do you think, as you mentioned, that they just would rather let him continue to run it now that all has been forgiven?
I don't know what I think there.
Okay.
Still dealing with the announcement from yesterday. I just can't believe Prigozhin's out and about. That article in the Times today, by the way, had a lot of the details you mentioned yesterday about Prigozhin. The quote in here is, he showed up last Thursday in a big old BMW, drives up to some of his properties. He's hauling out bags of money. He goes to the FSB. I didn't know this. They claim that he went to an FSB office to meet with people there, and they told him, you know, everything's okay. And then he's getting money and weapons back. Now, I don't know how accurate this is. This sounds too weird, because just a few days earlier, you noted, the FSB was gathering all this stuff in some of his office buildings.
The world's eyes will be on how this all plays out. And one thing's for sure, that it's anyone's guess what will happen, but it's still worth analyzing it with someone as smart and insightful as you are, Peter. So thank you so much. This is such an incredible story. It reads like a novel, but it's real life. So it was awesome getting your insights and very helpful for us to understand the historical context and some of the motivations and what makes people like Putin and Prigozhin tick.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Amy. One last thought. Most places where I've been in a management position, nobody is irreplaceable. I always tell people, well, what would happen to the organization if you got hit by a bus tomorrow? So I'm thinking here about Mr. Prigozhin. I mean, as much as we say, and I've said, you know, he seems pretty invaluable, and who's going to run the company? But what if he had a heart attack tonight?
Right.
Well, is the company just going to dissolve and buy up overnight, or is somebody else going to come in and run it?
No, someone else will come in and run it, right?
They'll come in and run it, and presumably Putin would have a hand in that decision. And I meant that, you know, not just he would be found or poisoned, but I mean, what if he actually got hit by a bus and dropped dead? Heart attack, problem solved, and away from Putin. But I always am open to the idea that change happens and nobody is completely replaceable, even Putin.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right about that. And it was noted in the article that you gave an interview for in the New Yorker about how almost half of these authoritarian regimes end in the dictator just dying.
Yeah, I think Andrew Taylor's written a lot of work during hundreds of centuries. It's fascinating what the data shows. Yeah, most of them die in office. And then there's all these creepy, like I was thinking through this the other day about, look at all the regimes that have been in power now for years. Assad being one of them, his father, now him, since the late 60s, early 70s, is the Castro brothers, since the late 50s. Of course, they're both deceased now, but it's still that regime still in place. And then the one that always amazed me was Robert Mugabe took a perfectly healthy, thriving country in 80 and ran it to the ground. And it was a completely failed state. The economy had just about died. And yet he was still in power. And then there's the Soviet Union. After World War II, pretty battered country. They slowly rebuilt the economy, never a healthy economy. And yet the Soviet system survived until 1991.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to by then. Gorbachev accelerated its demise. Someone else had been named general secretary in 1985. I don't argue the Soviet Union could be a while longer, well beyond 1991.
I always imagine there's like another strand in the multiverse where that happened. They are just a very upstanding global citizen and they've got a thriving economy and the people there are happy. Like, I mean, wouldn't that just be so wonderful?
It would be great. But that is our bias and our perception and our perspective. Putin's perspective is the only thing that matters is stability. No revolution, no chaos.
No dissent, no free speech.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. As you mentioned, I'm not surprised at all that you, in high school, watched one movie and it took you down this road because it really is such a truly fascinating culture and it's so different from ours and it's so complex that we're grateful you're here to unpack it for us.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Peter, thank you so much for your time. We hope you'll come back to Fordham again.
Anytime. Take care.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.